This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Realizar que hay 3 millones de personas ahorita que son esclavos de ese sistema.
Alegra Padilla es integrante del grupo comunitario Homies Unidos, una organización que lucha por transformar las vidas de los jóvenes dentro y fuera de las pandillas y proveer información que ayude a la autodefensa de la ciudadanía. En Los Ángeles, yo soy Fernando Velázquez.
Y así llegamos al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a todas las personas que hicieron posible este programa. A nombre de Rolando Solano y de Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez. Gracias por su atención. Los esperamos el día de mañana.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPod o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org en los archivos de audio.
Yeah, Formativo is over, and you had a moment to think about it. You know? I mean, it wasn't a planned or programmed moment. We didn't say, let's give people a moment or two to think about it, but that's what happened. It just was one of those halitory moments, you know, and I was startled because Peter Walker, who is my honored guest this morning, took his guitar out and touched the strings, and I was stricken. And maybe he'll give us a bit. I was going to play something from one of his many records, but I must tell you something about who Peter Walker is and how important he is in my, my universe of great instrumentalists and souls. Peter Walker did a recording in the days gone by, the 60s, I'm sure you've. Sure, you've heard of them. The 60s, that was kind of, it was like the confluence of a couple of very important streams in music. Peter Walker, superb guitarist, began to play ragas on the guitar. Now, this was before George Harrison had his romance with Indian music, before Ravi Shankar was even around New York City. And there are people out in the hall who are carrying on. You can probably hear them carrying on. What's going on? See, we're having a marathon here. We're having a fun drive. And that means that things are a little looser than usual, which is not a bad thing. I think it's a very good thing. But I was telling you about Peter Walker and how he brought the raga to the attention of the, I don't know, the radio public, the record-buying public, by doing something called Rainy Day Raga, which was one of the very first FM hits in the 60s. It was wonderful. I don't think we can get him to play it now, although the recording is out.
I'll play something remarkably similar to it on steel strings. very shortly, and I'll do it with an innovative new technique, which really duplicates Ravi Shankar's technique with a high-speed right hand, because all of these intervening years since we played on 66 and 67 all night long, every night on WBAI, a lot of them have been spent in study. And in, when I have a trainer, a personal trainer in Spain, and it's in hand development. And he says the world has been waiting for a guitarist to come along with fully developed right and left hands. And he's done a lot of work with me in developing hands so I can play stuff the way Ravi does, with his super double high-speed back-and-forth technique, which produces overtones and extra notes. But I'll do that for you later if I can, if I get this.
All right, well, why don't you put those earphones on? You'll have a better idea of where you are in relation to the microphone. And I should say this is Radio Unnameable. My name's Bob Fast. That's Peter Walker over there. There are various other people in the room ready to be introduced to spin their view of things. We'll be talking this morning about a Shonda for the Glam. We're going to be talking about Rubashkin, the terrible, awful capitalist who happens to be a purveyor of kosher meat, and the unspeakable human rights and animal rights conditions that he presides over in his factories. He also has a history of being the distributor of gallons and gallons of toxic waste. He had some kind of an establishment where he had these things stored in leaky containers. He was fined by the government, and he said, "We'll let them drop dead." He didn't decide to pay the bill. And then I want to talk about a different kind of kosher slaughter, which is almost mystical. I had an experience once that was taken by a friend of mine whose father was a rabbi, to a place, a butcher, an abattoir, where he slayed one calf, which was enough to provide veal for all of the people who wanted to eat kosher veal in Newark. And all around this man, there were, I don't know how else to describe them, but alienated people who were listening to radios and smoking cigarettes and ripping the throats and out of cattle as though they were not alive. And this man, this rabbi, who was in his 80s, went to a little table, spread a kind of a shawl on the table, put another one on his shoulders, and began to pray. And he took out a black case, and in the case there was a long knife. And he sighted along the edge of the knife, and he wasn't satisfied with the sharpness of it. He honed it, and he held it up, looked all right. He dragged it along his nail. Oh, he felt a little nick, and he took that out. And afterwards, he explained to me, "When I cut the throat of the calf, I dastn't let him feel it. If he feels it, then, as far as I'm concerned, it's not truly kosher, because the animal must experience no pain. Now, this was in a room where the cattle were led up to a kind of a chute, and they were shackled on their rear leg and swung out over this vast, bloody amphitheater, which where steam was issuing forth and where these men were grabbing the bellowing cattle as they came past and eviscerating them. And the calf came down to where my friend's father was stationed, and he put his arms around the head of the calf, and he whispered something in its ear, and the calf stopped shaking and stopped bellowing and just became almost willing. It was really, truly a mystical experience. And then he slaughtered it, and he opened it up. He took out the lungs, and he blew into the lungs to see whether they were whole or not. And he said, if there's one spot, I can't certify this. And he said, the calves today, they keep them locked up. They feed them sugar water. They never walk to keep their flesh white. I was really impressed by the difference between the alienated work that was done probably minimum wage butchers and this guy who was doing it for, I said, what do you say to the calf when you whisper something in its ear? He said, I say, please excuse me for doing this. I'm doing it because God told me to. So I said, shifting the blame, huh? He said, well, you want to say that, but it's not it. It's that we eat by the death of other life. So he had a profound idea about it. And this guy, Rubashkin, who my guest Elizabeth Dwoskin wrote about this week, has another attitude. What he reveres, I believe, is money. So maybe you can just say hello, and we'll talk later after we hear some music to clear the air after that all that blood.
Sure. I mean, first of all, there are many Rubashkins. Aaron Rubashkin, who's in his mid-80s today, is an older man who has 8 children, and they have many grandchildren, and all the Rubashkin businesses are far-flung across the country, and they're all family businesses. But Aaron Rubashkin, who's the patriarch and the strong patriarch who came from Russia from a long line of Lubavitch family, he saw an ad in the Wall Street Journal in 1987 for a dilapidated factory in Postville, Iowa, a town which had signified the decline of the American farm belt for a long time. And he bought the factory, and he was just a kosher caterer in Brooklyn. He didn't have any national enterprises. And what the community says is that he was motivated by the desire to bring kosher meat to every far-flung corner of America. And people say before the Rubashkins, the legend, which is partially true, is that before the Rubashkins, a Jew from Kansas City would have to drive 7 hours to Chicago to buy a piece of meat. And the Rubashkins...
Or to buy a Senate seat.
Or to buy a Senate seat. And the Rabashkins made it so that in every far-flung corner of America, in Walmart, you could get kosher meat. And supposedly the myth is that they did that because that was a religious desire. Supposedly Aaron Rubashkin was pained by the thought of a Jew not eating kosher because he wasn't available to him. Well, but they ended up building a huge empire.
And paying undocumented immigrants less than the minimum wage with no safety program, no training. Some as young, you say, as 16. One of them lost a finger, which would have... I guess, Django Reinhardt didn't have a full...
Django Reinhardt had two fingers of his left hand where the tendons were tightened by a burn from a fire. He was married. His wife had made some flowers out of cellulose materials in the wagon. He returned, and the candle tipped over. And in the ensuing fire, his right leg was damaged, and two fingers of his left hand were curled tight. Throughout the rest, he was still able to use them for some notes, but he had to bring his thumb over, which is forbidden in Spanish guitar circles, to play the notes on the bottom string. But also, as you get older, fingering gets simpler as you figure out ways around problems.
Well, Aaron Rubashkin figured out the way to make a lot of money.
It sounds like a good service that he performed. I mean, before he existed, there was one kind of reality, and afterwards, at least,
that's the myth, but the reality is that he pushed a lot of people out of business in the process, and doing so by, mafia-esque tactics. Where
sounds like some taxi drivers.
One of the things that he did was to call immigration and naturalization when his employees showed signs of forming a union. What a nice guy. You you were on the in any number of folk scenes in the United States, and then in the late 70s, I kind of lost track of you, Peter, and you, next time I saw you, you said that you were going to be studying, to be a paralegal, studying law.
Yeah, I my kids came up to school age, and it was either, well, it was a lot of bad choices that I had to choose from, but fortunately I wound up having an apartment in New York City at about that time, and I got a job working in a garage. And the phone rang one day, and I was teaching Spanish people how to clean the floor and get the, because clean floors mean clean engines mean less maintenance. And so, and the phone rang, and I settled an accident case on the phone involving the door of a cab. And I explained to this insurance guy that it took $450 worth of materials and 8 hours labor to change all those little parts inside the door. So he wound up giving me $1,700. And the owners of the cab fleet came back from lunch. And they said, did anybody call? And I said, yeah, I took $1,700 for the door. Is that all right? And the next morning, I had 4 filing cabinets full of files. I had 3 secretaries. I had a charge account at a detective agency and a charge account at the DMV. And that's what I did for the next 10 years. And the kids went to school, and I bought a house.
And then I went back to music. Sometime along that path, you met Karen Dalton in the street.
Oh, I met Karen in the early 60s.
But, I mean, you ran into her when she was in trouble.
Well, she used to get rides. She was living in the Bronx, and I used to, she knew I was commuting from Woodstock to the city to do this job. So I often drove her back and forth. And it came a time when someone offered her a house up in Woodstock, so she took that. And she actually, contrary to the rumors, she was really in pretty well cared for during her final few years. I didn't know how many people with AIDS had a heated swimming pool in the middle of winter in Woodstock. She had that for a few years. She was still able to feed her own wood stove in a charming place. And towards the end, she had a nice little house in Hurley, New York. And her son was with her. So she did not die destitute and alone on the streets of New York. That's not true. And she did die eventually. I'm sorry, Monty Dunn isn't here tonight. As I was driving in, I was thinking of all the nights when Monty and I slept up the stairs carrying all our gear. And Monty passed away a few months ago. And it really has been on my mind this evening, so anything I play is dedicated to him tonight. Thank you.
Some recently released recordings by Karen Dalton. You remember her when she was in Boulder.
I didn't know her then. Joe Loop recorded those at his coffee house in Boulder, and he sold them to a French company which did these releases. And nicely enough, they also paid the children, which I thought was a really decent thing for them to do. Delmore Records gets a lot of credit for that, Mark Lynn. It was part of the release process for the new Karen Dalton releases. And I think it's nice to see an artist respected by the people that are making money off of her voice and talents. And also nice to see something going to the children. My hat's off to them. And of course, to Karen, boy, since she cut quite a swath, didn't she? For a woman with a limited output of material, she's being remembered so well, and she's really popular in Europe.
She has a kind of a reputation that she would have enjoyed having when she was alive. You know, I remember I had her on the air a couple of times, and she came out to New Jersey when I was on WFMU, and the audience response was overwhelming, but she didn't seem to.
It's amazing to me. I toured 26 cities 2 years ago when they released that tribute album. And everywhere I went, when I mentioned I was playing Karen's guitar, people would come up afterwards and just want to touch it. I had no idea. There's this cult-like reverence that women have for her in this country. It seems to be mostly women. I mean, in Europe, it was mixed, but here in this country, there's something going on with people who just revere her.
I'm looking for a version of It Hurts Me Too. I can't seem to find that. She does a heartbreaking version of that. Hey, speaking of heartbreak, WBAI is in a fund drive, and we haven't done anything to mend our broken heart here. We need your support. This is one of those times when WBAI is really, truly concerned about being thrown out of the building, not being able to pay our rent, and not being able to pay our electrical bills. This is the end of a long, long string of marathons that didn't quite achieve what we hoped they would. And this is the wolf is at the door. And I don't know, maybe you'd like to say something about it.
Well, hi, this is Mitchell Cullen here in...
No, I have a question, Mitch. The reason I didn't introduce you was I'm concerned about the fact that you might be running for some kind of office in our democratically elected board of directors, and I might be...
There's no election this go-around until another...
I thought he was going to be the new governor of Illinois.
I tried to get my bribe in, but they didn't want to take my $5. So the bribery in Illinois seems to be going pretty cheaply, actually, looking at the records of what the governor there was charged with. It's nothing that politicians don't seem to be doing all over the place, but he's getting called on it. I wonder what the reason is. Anyway, back here at BAI, we are in a very, very serious cash situation. It's not only WBAI, it's the entire network. We're part of Pacifica Radio, which has stations out in LA and Berkeley, California, and Houston, Texas, and Washington, D.C., and here in New York City, and affiliates
all over.
Ah.
Yeah. So I wasn't on that whole time, so I spun over.
There you are.
I'll spot over.
Well, I think people heard most of it, but they had to strain. Now it'll be a little easier for them.
Well, as I was saying, WBAI is in a desperate financial crisis, as is the whole network. And we're trying desperately to raise the kind of funds that we need.
For once, it isn't just us. The National Public Radio Bulletin Board announced that they're cutting jobs all over the network, and they're doing away with a couple of programs.
Yeah, there was 25% of the paid staff was laid off here at BAI, and it's a very serious situation that we're in. And so we have some premiums, I believe. Well, Bob has some great official premiums that he's going to be offering, and I also brought for anybody, I have unofficial premiums just for this show tonight. So I brought my two poetry books that are out with me, and I pledge to send them to anybody who contributes $25 via credit card tonight while we're on the air. And I brought envelopes with me and stamps, and we will bypass the whole premiums process here at WBAI, and I'll mail them out to you right now from the studio if you pledge $25 to WBAI, at least via Bob Fass's show. Now, the number to call is a good question. I don't know what... Do you know what the number is?
Well, I think I do. 209-212-209-2950.
Now, these are the unofficial premiums, so when you get somebody answering that phone, you have to say you want Mitchell's poetry books. One-Eyed Cat Takes Flight is the new one, and the older one, not that much older, is The Permanent Carnival. And I might even get a chance in a little while to read from some of them as we go late into the night. Well, but the situation here, I'm sorry, at BAI, Tony Riddle is the new general manager for the past year, and he's under amazing pressures to try and steady this place. And we need help in doing that. I happen to be the chair of the local station board, who was reelected again last night at a five-hour marathon local station board meeting, which we could have certainly used some of the wonderful music and insight that's been put out here. But it went, and it was productive. And we encourage people who are listening to show up at these board meetings as well. There's also, well, maybe Bob, you want to talk about what the other premiums are?
Well, yes, there are two other premiums, and a very limited number of a third and a fourth. Paul Krasner has given us copies of his latest, I guess it's a pamphlet, but it is a survey of the pornography industry as it manifests itself on the internet. And not only is it entertaining, but it's entertaining. And I don't know how useful it is. He discusses everything from the aristocrats to a certain kind of unmentionable German eschatological pornography. And as I read it, I am overwhelmingly in awe of the power of the sexual impulse that manages, no matter how twisted, no matter how suppressed, to manifest itself in some bizarre and wonderful fashion. It's quite a book, and it's quite a world. There's a little photograph or copy on the back of the book of his very famous the orgy in Disneyland when it was announced that Walt Disney had joined his the great cartoon factory in the sky. And it's also very funny, but you have to have a magnifying glass. The Disneyland Memorial Orgy. And that's another one of the premiums. The third, and I hope the one that you are most eager to get, is a copy of Chicago 10, a DVD of the movie of, well, in 1968, a bunch of us thought that the Democrats, in nominating, as they were clearly going to do, Hubert Humphrey, were opting for death, that they were going to prolong Johnson's war in Vietnam, and that many, many young Americans would be killed, not to mention many, many, many East Asians would be killed. And we went to Chicago to perform a counter demonstration, a convention of life. Allen Ginsberg and Abby Hoffman and Paul Krasner and the MC5 and Jerry Rubin and Rennie Davis and thousands of other people went to the streets of Chicago. I was among them.
It was spontaneous, wasn't it?
Well, what happened was a spontaneous overreaction by the police. And without any provocation, there was what the Kerner Commission called a police riot. And heads were broken, apartments were invaded, people were trashed in what we used to think of as the American way. And naturally, the city of Chicago was a bit somewhat worse for wear. There was gas shot into the lobby of the Hilton Hotel, and people who were delegates to the convention who went out into the street to support the people who were against the war were beaten by the police and clubbed, and I was one of those people, too. I have I have memories of being herded down the street by police clubs into other polices with gas grenades and coughing and laughing as all this was going on. It was, in some ways, a great, great American scene. The phrase that you may have heard, "the whole world is watching," was coined in the streets of Chicago at that time. And as a result, afterwards, they had to have a trial. And Abby Hoffman, Bobby Seale, Rennie Davis, John Freund's...
Lee Weiner.
Lee Weiner. And other Dave Dellinger, other peace advocates, were indicted for conspiracy to cause trouble.
And when you say it was coined, what do you mean it was coined? Who invented it?
People in the street began to say it as they noticed the television cameras and people... something really, I guess, lucky happened in those weeks. There was an electrical strike. Electrical workers struck, and so the live cameras could not go out into the street, but the networks had hundreds and hundreds of 16-millimeter cameras in the street, 16-millimeter sound cameras. And there were, every confrontation was filmed from, you know, 20 different angles. And there's,
So these were the first mass protests that were filmed on network television?
That's
so
right.
Thoroughly?
Not,
that's why?
They were, yes, and some of them were live. And people were beaten in front of their families at home, and it was clear that the government of the United States, which used to be a terrible government, was willing to sacrifice its young people in the streets of Chicago as well as in the streets without joy in Vietnam. And the trial, which happened about a year later, for some reason, I guess they thought that we were journalists, Paul Krasner and I, were unindicted co-conspirators, but Abby and Jerry and the gang were indicted. And they were so outraged at the injustice of being charged with what the police provoked and what the police did that they decided to make the trial into a kind of circus. And they had plenty of help from the prosecution and from the judge, who was, to be kind, he was kind of an Elmer Fudd.
What was his name?
Hoffman. The same
Judge
name
Hoffman?
As Abby Hoffman.
And they were, what were they indicted for? Conspiring to disturb the peace?
Conspiracy to well,
that's
it
an
was,
indictment.
It was a thought crime. They were indicted for, well, first, as Jerry Rubin says at one point in it, how can you incite someone to riot? If someone riots, it's because they want to riot. It's not because you told them to. It's because they felt that there was reason to riot. And the police certainly thought that these long-haired travelers from all over the country, actually from all over the world, William Burroughs ran out of the park with Jean Genet, and it was an amazing event. And the trial was, Phil Oakes testified, and Norman Mailer testified, and I believe Truman Capote and Gore Vidal testified. People who came from the flower of the anti-war movement. Judy Collins testified. People who felt outraged at the war and thought that these people were expressing their own distaste for it. And Bobby Seale objected to being part of... He didn't even remember what it was he said. He was in Chicago one day during the Festival of Life, and he was indicted. He didn't remember what it was for. And his lawyer, a guy named Gary, was having an operation in California, and he said he wanted to be represented by Gary or to represent himself. And he insisted on his right to be represented by himself. And the judge didn't want any part of it. He told him to sit down and shut up, and he was forcibly restrained in the courtroom. They dragged him outside of the courtroom. They tied him, chained and gagged him, and brought him back into the courtroom. It was a horror, a real horror. And there were moments during the trial that I actually attended a session of the trial, and there were moments of the trial that were high comedy. There were others that were very frightening. And the Chicago 10 is a movie about that. 10, because although 8 people were indicted, 7 of them actually stood trial, all of the lawyers for the defense were judged by the judge to be in contempt of court, and all of the defendants were sentenced.
You saw Kunstler try that case?
Yes, yes.
Oh, that must have been a marvelous experience.
Right.
I saw Bailey once try a case, and that was an interesting experience. Because
you worked with Kunstler, didn't you?
Yes, I did on 2 cases.
Yeah.
One that comes to mind was the John Sinclair case.
Right.
In Michigan, Kunstler had come into town and he'd filed an appeal and he'd lost. And so he'd lost the appeal, and the Rainbow People's Party had organized the funding for the benefits that paid Kunstler to come out and do that. Well, he did it pro bono because it was for the right cause. But then he turned to, as he did strategically, to the political solution. If he couldn't have a legal solution, he would go for a political solution. And so this lovely story arrives 4 or 5 in the morning. John Lennon, the phone tree gets to work, and John Lennon arrives on a Saturday morning around 5 a.m. At 8 a.m. it's visiting hours at the state prison. So at 8 a.m. arrives John Lennon, and the phone tree has been busy, and he's with 35,000 people. And he knocks on the door of the prison, literally. Who are you and what do you want? Comes over the squawk. Well, I'm John Lennon, and I want to see my mate, John Sinclair. That's absolutely ridiculous. And who are these people with you? Oh, these are my friends. They want to see him, too.
35,000 friends?
Yeah, 35,000 people, which is a pretty significant number for a prison. And, of course, they're so uptight, they can't believe how uptight they are with 35,000 people outside the prison.
That's sort of like what Dick Gregory did in Chicago in 68, where I was part of the march with my dad and my brother and some friends. We came out from Brooklyn, and we were going to march to the amphitheater where the Democratic Party convention was being held, and the police weren't letting us march.
So Dick Gregory invited everybody to
his house, to a barbecue. At that time, he was not a vegetarian. Coming to a barbecue at his house, which was on the way to the amphitheater, and he said, I have the right, and the police says, well, sorry, we're not going to let you do that. And he said, this is my right. They're all coming about maybe 7,000 or 8,000 of us, I guess, maybe less than that,
he
coming
had the
to
right
his
to
house.
Have you over the afternoon.
He had the right to, and they had the right property. To tear gas the hell out of us. I remember very vividly we were getting totally tear gassed at that time, and my dad, who was in the Marines in World War II, and he was wearing his medals, his heroism medals there, but he was against the war, and so he would always show his medals to these police or military police who were in all the jails at the time. And he goes, well, I've been tear gassed before, so I and my brother were supposed to wear the two handkerchiefs that he had with them. And of course, he was the first one to go down from the tear gas. So I've been experienced. It won't affect me. Well, of course it affected him. We had to carry him 240 pounds to the Red Cross or the local people who were taking care of the health crisis happening from the tear gas. And so we inched our way back, and then we would walk forward again. So they would tear gas us again and again and again. But each time we would be pushed back maybe another 100 yards until we were right outside all these hotels that Bob was talking about before, when people started chanting. I remember somebody said, they're watching us in France. So somebody jumped in and said, yeah, the whole world is watching. And then people just started chanting that. And it was quite amazing.
And there was something in the world at that moment. Because in Prague and in other cities around the world, the young people were saying, no more murder, no more repression.
There was something going on in the world, Bob. When Obama was elected, I was in Lima, Peru.
Yeah.
In Pizza Alley, and I just watching with everyone else. Lima's interesting. Even there's no police looking for crime during a football match. Everybody in the world looking at all those screens they have everywhere. You know, they can watch free from the street. Everybody's watching the election, and they didn't quite understand the our electoral system. So when it actually went over the 360, I said, "That's it." And then the whole restaurant turned to me. Yeah, that's it. Obama. And you can get down there tomorrow. I'll walk around saying Obama, and they'll think they'll know you've been seeing me. It was quite a celebration. The whole world was happy for us.
I remember I used to live in Brazil, and I have a lot of Brazilian friends. And I remember even 8 months ago, a Brazilian friend came to visit me in New York, and he said to me, "Well, we all know Obama's going to win." I said, "Oh, you do? Because we're still in the primaries."
No, they were surprised.
He said, "Brazil knows. Everybody knows Obama's going to win."
The world thought the world racism knew. Here ran so deep that it was impossible, and they were so pleased and delighted because. What did the gypsies say to me several years ago? They said, "Peter, you know, it must be a wonderful country because you can be born in a log cabin and grow up to be president, or you can be the village idiot and be president." Mm-hmm. Referring to the administration. And so they really believe we had control over our own elections. But this time we did. We took control of our own elections, and we put someone in who's appropriate. And the whole world is just so surprised. It's a wonderful sharing of happiness. I don't know how it was in the city, but there it was the warmest feelings in the world.
Well, I think surprised, but I think also, you know, what I saw in my friend, like my friend is, you know, a black Brazilian. And, you know, he would never believe that a black man like himself could be elected in Brazil. But they still have that belief about America. And I think, you know, from a distance, like when I was there, we were all caught up in the primaries. But I think from a distance, people in the world could see the tide of history that, you know, that Obama's election represented
the
deep desperation.
In that moment,
the deep desperation of this country. And even somehow from afar, because he wasn't mired in the primaries and mired in the horse race of it all. That he said, "Oh yeah, everyone in Brazil knows he's going to win. It's like it's time." And that was kind of the tide of how America voted.
That's
and I thought,
insightful.
from a distance, people were able to see that in some ways.
Yeah, the people I talked to were so surprised. They were so hopeful and they're so glad, but they were so stunned.
Well, I was out here in Brooklyn.
They hadn't dared hope.
In Brooklyn, I was hanging out with three other people. None of the four of us voted for Obama or McCain. I voted for McKinney. The other three voted for different socialist candidates. But we were in a bar that night watching the returns, and the excitement was so infectious. People were so filled with hope.
Yeah.
People were... It was quite an amazing experience being there. And when, as you said, when it went over the top, mm-hmm. people poured out into the streets with their glasses of beer and wine where we were. And there were hundreds of people out on the streets in on each street corner all over Brooklyn. Where we were, I actually counted.
Where were you?
I was on Flatbush Avenue and 7th and Park Slope.
Okay.
There were people all over the place, though, that were stopping traffic. Everybody was honking their cars, their horns. Yeah. And it was enthusiastic.
Brooklyn was incredible.
Yeah.
I'll never forget Brooklyn.
And I got a call from my daughter, who was up in Boston, who is 19 years old. She's going to school there. And she said, "Well, Dad, I'm a little drunk right now." And then she goes, "You know, everybody is playing guitars and hugging each other, and thousands of people are out here on the Boston Commons." And she says, "So this is what the 60s was like." And I had a choice then of saying, "Well, it wasn't exactly," but I didn't know. But it is for her, so that's fine.
That was our hope in the 60s.
Because we all had that moment, though. I want to give a plug to Pacifica here. Because we all had that moment does not mean that the whole process is over. It really means it's just begun. You know, well, we witnessed that night with people coming together, and the forces of good prevailing over the forces of evil, clearly, with the choice being war and peace here. And so now, if we continue to all work together, perhaps we can accomplish some other great things in the world, like achieving the goals that we have the hope for Obama achieving.
Well, in the civil rights movement, did you believe that there could be a black president? Did you believe that in the civil rights movement?
Did I believe?
Yeah.
I ran away from home when I was 14. I went to Grand Ole Opry, and then I went into the Deep South. There was still segregation then. Segregation, moonshine, and it was incredibly dangerous. So it was a horror show, a place to even be. Medieval would be a good way to describe it. Coming from that era, I would never have thought so, no. No, I never would. I began to hope, but like with a lot of things, you don't dare hope. You try not to hope, because if you do, Murphy's Law will work against you.
You're on the air.
Yeah. So I'm on the air. And
Bob, it's Jim Ferrat.
Let Bob talk.
It's Jim Ferrat. Hi. Jim, wow, welcome.
We're having...
Put your earphones on.
Your
phone is kind of breaking up, Jim. Hello?
Sorry about that. It's a landline phone, but it's an old building.
Jim Ferrat from the 60s?
Well,
yep.
From, I tried to find you
from
one
60s
time. How are you? God bless you.
Do you resent being associated with that time, Jim?
Not at all, but I don't believe in nostalgia and mythologizing who we were then now. I think we really need to tell the truth about who we were and the great things that we did, the mistakes we made, and how we can share that today in this new political reality. But, Bob, the reason I'm calling is Peter's music brought me back to that time before Chicago, before the Yippies, when in West Village, the LSD church established a storefront, and Peter used to play there. And I think what we really need for fundraising to keep the station on the air is more of the kind right now of vibe and centering that Peter's music did then and certainly did for me tonight. I'm just so grateful to hear it.
Well, Peter, you were the house musician, the official musician at Millbrook. We worked with Tim Leary.
Yes, I was. His musical director, they called me.
Uh-huh.
My mission in life, I feel like I go in this year, I want to tour Europe coming up soon. Every country in Western Europe, like 2 months of gigs. And it'll be very tiring, but I feel like I'm on a mission, because my mission is to fuse American folk music and what its history was and its roots were in European music, and where the roots of European music came from, the gypsy culture of the 8th and 12th centuries, which was imported from India. So by tracing these musical roots, what I'm trying to do is fuse the world's music together into one type of music, which incorporates all these different disciplines, histories, and cultures. That's my mission. And I'm pretty close to having a few smoking guns in the historical trail. And I get so excited about them, I go around and I go on stage and I play these connections.
Well,
people seem to like it.
There's a big Moorish element in Spanish music as well, is there not?
Well, the Moors, you see, okay. The Moors in the 8th century conquered India. prizes of war weren't just gold and jewels. They were skilled artisans. They were really terrific fighters. And there were particularly brave people were cultivated as prizes of war. Beautiful women were cultivated as prizes of war. And talented musicians and dancers were prizes of war. And they were shipped back to the capital, which was at the Alhambra in present-day Granada, Spain. So that's how the gypsy culture got from Spain to India. They're called Carlos. There's different kinds of gypsies, but the ones that do flamenco are called Carlos.
And Alexander's army had something to do with it, too, didn't
they? I have no idea about anything about it. I know the northern migration of the Romanies was in the 17th century. So this musical that I'm trying to learn and play, and I'm just it's the instrument and what's possible through the historical route to connect the Spanish music to the ancient gypsy music to the ancient Indian music, because they originally were Indian musicians from Spain, bringing 8th century Canadic music to Spain, and then it flowed through Europe, this musical system. And Ali Akbar Khan is my source for a lot of this information, and some of the old Spanish families have confirmed, yeah, we were kidnapped. We were kidnapped about 850 and brought here. We should know, it's a family tradition. Never forget, we're the long-lost children of Madras and Bengal.
Hey, Bob.
Yes, Jim.
Want to hear something?
See, what Peter's doing right now is, to me, what the immigration debate is about today. You know, the diversity of the culture that Peter is talking about, which weaves together the different cultures into this sort of quilt of sound, is what, in the United States, immigrants have always brought to this country. And it is who America really at its soul and core has been historically. The fact that the social contract has been destroyed by the variety of administrations, including the Clintons, has created a time that we have lost touch with the humanity that the music that Peter plays, that you bring on the air, that BAI people play in between some of the political stories. That kind of music is what can resonate and bring the kind of hope together into people's souls and hearts that casting a vote for Obama did. So I'm really, you know, this is what BAI is to me. You know, it's hearing Peter and you having this discussion, hearing the frame of references that comes out of that to the political context of our lives, as well as the soul context and the cultural context. So I'm really, really so happy I'm listening to this tonight.
Well, it's a perfect lead-in to the premium that I was talking about before, the Chicago 10 movie. You appear in the movie.
I think that's a terrible movie, Bob.
I'm so glad to know you're alive and well, Jim. I'm so delighted to hear your voice. I cannot begin to tell you.
You think it's a terrible movie?
Well, I think it's a terrible movie because what it tells young people today, it mythologizes people in a way that doesn't show their flaws and doesn't show their humanity as a consequence. I think Brett, you know, and this is not about Paul. I think Paul lost control of what his vision was in terms of what the director and the Hollywood people did to the film. You know, I'm not going to say it's the worst movie ever made. It's certainly better than that horrible Abbie Hoffman film, which was so one-dimensional. But the real story of that cultural time and of these players that were in it, which you and I had parts in it, I think is yet to be told, and it can't be told in a two-hour movie. The best thing about the Chicago 10 movie and why people should get the premium, so they can disagree with me if they want, is the animation. Because the animation on that film is the only way to really tell the story if you're going to make it into caricature and mythologizing people. Well, I can see I caught silence on the other end.
Wow. You've come and you've just, you've kicked over our suitcase where we were playing the shell game there.
Well, no, I think it's a good premium. I have a strong opinion on this, but you know, you're only going to have a strong opinion when something is on the table that causes you to react to it.
Well, Jim, it's not the first time I've disagreed with you. But I've never stopped loving you. I think you're usually right, but in this case, I think there's something more to be said for the film than you have. So How about this book of Paul's that we're offering you? You have something negative to say about that, too?
I have something very positive to say about it.
Okay, phew.
Let's hear it for
pornography.
Pornography, what Paul really exposes is the sort of the duplicitous morality that we have in this country. And, raunchy, healthy sexual writing should not be called pornography. Pornography is basic. Paul and I...
I call it healthy activity, but I feel guilty about it.
Well, go to church, confess, and do it again.
Do you remember Randall's Island, Jim?
I do remember Randall's Island.
Boy, that was something. You're a hero. You are a hero, sir.
Well, thank you, Bob.
Yes.
Please let me, I don't want your listeners to think that I totally am against the Chicago 10 film. I think it deserves to be seen, but it deserves to be seen in the context of a discussion. And what the entertainment, movies as entertainment and history as entertainment, rarely can you have a really heartfelt and deep discussion, even when friends or comrades or allies may disagree or see the same event differently. One thing that's really good about that film, Bob, and I'm going to say this to you for your listeners, it finally puts you in the picture for what the role that you played in communicating with the listeners of Pacifica and BAI what was happening in Chicago around that trial. And I am very grateful for that.
Well, every night of the trial, practically, Abby called me and we talked about the events of the day. And these were moments that were not like the image of Abby that was current at the time.
And that's because of your relationship with Abby. You knew Abby before he became a media star. One of the first places that Abby actually made contact with larger audiences was on this very program that we're talking on tonight. And your cultural role in communicating and building community has been so undervalued. And I for one, and I'm sure Peter and those of us who were around at that time will say to anyone, if it wasn't for Bob and BAI, we would not have been able to organize the community in the way that we did in 1967, 1968, 1969.
Well, I'm glad you're out there, Jim. I've wanted to talk to you over the years many, many times. Maybe it'd be good if you could come up here sometime.
Absolutely, Bob. So I'm going to go back and listen to you, and I hope that Peter will play a little more music, okay?
I hope so, too. And let me say something else. This is WBAI in New York City and KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, and CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. And soon, maybe 20 minutes or so from now, we'll be joined by WJFF in Jeffersonville, Grahamsville, and Liberty, New York. I'm very glad you're out there, and perhaps we can hear some more of Peter's wonderful music. Thank you, Jim.
So, Liz, so yeah. You did the cover story. Bob didn't say it before in the Village Voice this week. Is that right? So maybe you could fill us in more about what that was. I didn't realize it in the Voice. And
oh, sure. Let's see. Am I on? Can I hear myself? I'm
a staff writer at The Voice, and basically back in May, there was this big scandal with the largest immigration raid in American history in a kosher meat processing plant in Iowa, the biggest in the country. And I had been spending time in Crown Heights just reporting for The Voice, so I knew that the Rubashkin name was a very famous name in Crown Heights, and a very well-known name. And the money from the Rubashkin plant, there's such huge donors to charity there in Crown, especially in the Lubavitch community and in their own community in Crown Heights, that all of a sudden I started thinking, I wonder how the people of Crown Heights are dealing with this chaos in this factory and in this family where myth, legend, and reality blend together about this family. Their good works are so well known in Crown Heights. It's what I learned, that, it's very hard for people to take any news about them being involved in widespread criminal activity. And so when I read about these crimes, or these indictments, and, about 16-year-olds working 17-hour days without any safety training, people cutting off their fingers. I mean, before that, the scandal with the plant was that, people for the PETA, people for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, had gone in there with video cameras in 2004 and had taken an undercover video of the slaughtering practices at the plant and had these terrible, had recorded these terrible images of, animals being deeply in pain, with this cut from their throat, blood on the floor everywhere, and not what's typically done in a meat processing plant or even in a kosher meat processing plant. Because the bottom line there was so important. They were, they paid probably the lowest wages in the nation of any, some of the lowest wages in the nation of any plant. Anyway, so when these indictments came out, I started to wonder, well, this family is from Brooklyn. This seems like a great New York story. What's going on in Brooklyn? Everyone's telling the story of Iowa. And so the story I wanted to tell was to follow the community as they watched this family that has iconographic status in their community collapse, and at the same time them being at the center of the crisis and in another way completely insulated from the crisis. People will tell you all the time in Crown Heights that they don't read the news. That's the big thing. We don't read the news. And so I followed them, and then it just happened as I was following them that things got worse and worse, and when I finally, on the eve of the story, the plant went bankrupt. And so, but at that point, the community had changed a lot, but I'd been working on it since June, so it was interesting to watch the community in that arc of this chaos.
Were you able to interview any of the family members themselves, or?
Well, when I first started doing the story, I contacted Moshe Rubashkin. And just to be clear, Moshe Rubashkin never ran the plant in Iowa. Aaron Rubashkin, who is the patriarch, had a lot of sons, and two of his sons, Shalom and Heshi, were the ones that ran the plant in Iowa, and Shalom was the CEO, until his father replaced him in the scandal. But Moshe is the one who's kind of like the big man on campus in Crown Heights, and the reason is because he's the head of this large nonprofit in Crown Heights called the Crown Heights Jewish Community Council, which gets hundreds of thousands of dollars in public fund, taxpayer money every year, and he's the chairman of the board. But he's also a twice convicted felon, and he is really the face of the Rubashkin family in Crown Heights as well. So he got elected every couple of years with a 70% margin of the vote. It was a very disputed election, but thousands of people voted for him. In Crown Heights, only men can vote, only married men can vote. And it's a really weird thing because this community council is basically a religious organization that gets public money, and yet it distributes food stamps to people in Crown Heights who aren't Orthodox, but is mainly focused on the Orthodox. So he has this major benefactor role, and the family's money often gets funded. I don't want to say because I couldn't exactly follow their money channels, but I know there's they do enormous amounts of charity, and in that community. And so it was almost like for people impossible to imagine that this family could do anything bad. And I spoke to Moshe, as I was saying, about what was going on in Iowa. And once these chaos happened in Iowa, Moshe, even though he was never involved all over the years, became very involved. And he told me the two things I remember he said to me that stood out were, he told me it was a blood libel. What was happening was a blood libel against his family.
By whom?
By the liberal Jewish media, self-hating Jews. That's what his sister told me. I spoke to his sister. It was a really strong term. A blood libel is the term for Christians in the Middle Ages accusing Jews of cannibalizing Christian children as an excuse to kill them. And this is what he said to me publicly about it. And the other thing he told me was that the best and brightest minds in the world are in Crown Heights.
Well, another angle to this council that you're talking about is there's a group of people in Crown Heights who have been fighting against the cell phone towers on their building, and they've been going to the council and to
that
everywhere
building?
Else. I don't know if it's that building. I have the address somewhere else. But all of the people in this building now, all of them have cancers or neurological disorders, and I'll get you that information. And because there's a whole pile of something like 18 or 20 cell phone towers on the top of the building, and they've been going around trying to get help from various sources, including the different synagogues and Jewish community in Crown Heights, in that area of Crown Heights. And they're meeting all sorts of, some success, some not. You know, people don't want to believe it. So that's a whole other aspect to the control over the political institutions in Crown Heights that the story just is a window into, in addition to the horror story that you were telling about, or that Bob was telling earlier about how the animals were slaughtered and everything else.
The community council, it has a lot of power and a lot of different levels because it elects the VOD, which is the Council of Rabbis that govern a lot of dealings in Crown Heights. They pick the rabbis that serve as the para legal system for the regular legal system, you know, so that they're solving their own disputes. And the other thing they do that's very important for the family is they pick the rabbis that certify all the kosher meat that comes in the neighborhood. So while the entire world is saying maybe Rabashkin meat, maybe there's something unkosher about the way they're slaughtering, in Crown Heights, the family is choosing the actual standards of kosher. So, that's really interesting about the cell phone towers. I wonder if are there more like cell phone towers in Crown Heights than in other neighborhoods?
Yeah, Crown Heights is one of the centers for where cell phone towers are. I mean, they're all over the place, but they're concentrated. Crown Heights and parts of Bay Ridge as well.
My grandfather used to say the reason we were having all these hurricanes was because of all those radios and the radio waves. And yet the radiation from the high-tension wires has been really proven. But my brother keeps yelling at me, yeah, but what about the radiation from the wires in your house? What about the radiation from this? Everything, and the sun's radiation is one level, but there's so many levels and types of radiation. But if it's true that these having all these being exposed this close to all this activity is bad for us, and I'm glad I'm going to the beach at Yalapa for a while and ride my horse. Healthier.
seven modes of key of E.
When you were in Spain, you would go to the caves
where the... I started in 2000.
Where the flamenco guitar was
I decided
split.
To do what hadn't I done with my life that I wanted to do. And I never finished my education over there, and I had a little money. So I went to Granada, and I was very disoriented at first, but they made me feel very welcome. And I wound up studying there with various teachers, and I came
across a trainer. They're not usually so welcoming to people who play their music without
that was what opened the doors. Yeah, I went to a cave one night where I was threatened with knives and surrounded and about to be pretty well destroyed. And the old man behind the bar, no, I heard about him. He's studying with somebody up in the hill, with the, you know, this guy up in there who's a teacher at the school. He says, he's with the school. It's okay.
I've seen some movies taken of the the families who they're
touchy.
But they sit in a kind of a semicircle, someone gets up and sings.
Well,
does a few dance steps, and two other people get up.
Exactly.
And
it's a growing process. And what typically, somebody will come in and they'll pick up a guitar and maybe play some chords, and then someone will sing, or they'll get the house guitar. But then if they, sing is pretty passionate, then a couple girls from the front cave, which is a bar, will come into the back cave. And the back cave is the music room. And the music, it's rounded, almost like big Buicks. They have these rounded shapes in the tops and these oval doorways. But usually the front, a commercial one, the front part of it is a bar. And along the edge they listen. And the room in the back, they make the circle. And with the hands clapping and the people all clapping, and they put the energy. And they seem to create, it's called the Haleador, and that's what they said, the Haleos. You call the spirits. And I was kind of useful, and the kids in the neighborhood called me the Haleador because I would go to the cave early and start playing. Then some other people come in and they start singing. And then maybe a couple of girls come back from the front bar and they start clapping.
Spirit is very important.
Where we get around the neighborhood, and two or three hours later you'd have a real... one night, I had to tell you a story, about three or four years ago, I'm in the World's Fair Flamenco, and this guy starts walking next to me. And I said, who are you? I'm Jose. Well, yes, nice. Hi, Jose. And he said, no, you don't understand. Pepe sent me. Well, Pepe who? You don't remember that night? The what night? That night in Granada, in the cave. My point is these spontaneous jams become significant events which are talked about for years, when they get a good session going. And I think it has a lot to do with the religion that they brought with them from from India, some form of ancestor, because the families make a circle, and especially on Saturday nights going into Sunday morning, and they dress up like it's Easter. And they talk to the ancestors, and then they have a Haleador for the family who taps the rhythms and does the melodies, and the whole family, in a cooperative effort, calls forth the spirits of the ancestors to come and join them. And they do it through these traditional musical formulas, which are fascinating to study. And I believe they're all rooted, like Ali Akbar Khan says, in the ancient music of India and what they could do with it. They could make you feel a certain way. They could make you paint a picture, sort of, in your mind. Cool. Great stuff. Fascinating. I'm very lucky to get as immersed in it and be able to afford to make so many trips. Then I went to Sevilla, and I opened my guitar case in a club. And now I work whenever I'm in Spain. I work in Sevilla at a place called Anselma's. It's a big gypsy venue in the Triana barrio of Sevilla. And it's just the best fun in the world, Bob, after all these years and all that study and practice, to play lead guitar on demand at Anselma's. It's really the kick of the century. I can't tell you. You want to see a happy camper, you see me at the end of the evening there. It's just so great. Those wonderful experiences have propelled me forward. And then this guy, the record company, found me and made a record, and now I can tour. And I make enough money touring to have a lot of fun. And so I live partly in South America.
Are you going to be appearing anywhere in the area?
Yeah, I have a lot of fun.
Are you going to be appearing anywhere in the area?
Not in this country, no. I started in Scotland in March 17th for a 2-month tour Scotland, UK, Netherlands, Norway, Scandinavia, Portugal, France, and Spain.
Wow.
It's fun playing in Spain. You know, they have a gypsy audience, and you go up there. What are they going to do? Are they going to throw rocks, or are they going to like it? Oh, they go,
Have they ever thrown rocks?
No, they like it very much. It's always very heartwarming.
Do they feel you're playing their music?
I don't play pure flamenco. I take a lot of liberties. You know, so if you're a purist, I'm sorry. You just can't clap along with what I do. But somebody, I did a concert.
Speaking of being purists, this is WBAI in New York City, and we're broadcasting at the moment on KWMD in Kisilov, Alaska, and on WJFF in Liberty, Grahamsville. We're heard in Monticello, and Peter Walker is here this morning. And Peter is one of the living legends of the electric guitar. Peter,
acoustic
guitar. Well, you said something about how you had trouble with making the electric guitar do the kind of things that you thought were important to do with the music.
I don't think I'm really trying to do something new and different in music. I'm trying to reach back in time and put together what was historically workable in music and bring it forward.
Mm.
But I don't know. Better things than I will ever do have already been done.
Well, here's someone who's done something quite wonderful. A listener in Brewster, New York. Is this Dr. Dudley Dickinson, who was subscribed to WBAI, and he will get a copy of this CD that I am unable to play in the control room, this DVD, rather, of Chicago 10. But I assure you, you'll find some things to laugh about, you'll find some things to be aghast about. And you'll see, in many cases, yourself being gassed. A lot of people listening were in the streets of Chicago at that time. And you watched the trial over your television set. And you remember Walter Cronkite, the most respected voice in American news at the time, saying over and over again that the city of Chicago was a police state. And there are shots of Mayor Daley's father, Mayor Daley, as he says, I've given the police orders to shoot to kill in the case of looting and arson. And he says the police are not there to cause disorder. They're there to preserve disorder. It's a wonderful slice of American history. And you can have it for subscribing to WBAI as a thank you gift. And we'll throw in a copy of Porn Soup. And while they last, a pad of notes that you can write to your to the radio station that you're listening to, and tell them whether or not you want more of the same.
Also,
I wish I could play this DVD for you, but for some reason the control room has been rearranged. Hasn't been cleaned, it hasn't been repaired, but the connections have been rearranged, and we can't. I even had Sydney come in and try to arrange to play it. Couldn't do it. Couldn't play it in the computer either. So you'll just have to take my word for it, or go online and look up the reviews of Chicago 10, which were mostly very positive, despite what Jim Ferrat just said. And Jim is a character in the movie, and he didn't like it. Well, You'll hear Hank Azaria, Dylan Baker, Nick Nolte, Mark Ruffalo, Roy Schneider, Liev Schreiber, Jeffrey Wright. It was directed by Brett Morgan, who won an Academy Award for The Kid Stays in the Picture. And it has Abby Hoffman at his most bemused. And since the what took place in the streets of Chicago was filmed, there's a lot of footage of people being dragged and smashed and clubbed and pursued, but there was nothing filmed or recorded, with one little exception, in the courtroom. So that is done as a cartoon, and it's you know, I think you'll enjoy it. I hope that you see your way clear.
I disagree with Jim. I'm going to really like it. I know I'm going to like it already, and I haven't even seen it yet.
Well, you will, Peter. And maybe you'll call up and give us a report on what it's like.
I want to move forward, not disagree about the past.
Well, then you could jump to the RNC and just a few years ago, which was take two of the what happened in Chicago without the tear gassing, though, here in New York City, where people were rounded up by all the webbing, the orange webbing, the plastic webbing. The police would just come down the street and sweep people up into these nets.
I have to say, that was very effectively done. Here in our home city, they demonstrated that they just mop, stop, wap, bop. And there was really no really fussing around. Entirely different tactics would have to be employed in order to be successful in countering a similar. I'm not sure what the strategies would be.
Right, and then people would put
Gandhi
into the
Gandhi and his non-cooperation, though, had a pretty good idea going.
Hundreds and hundreds of people were arrested for nothing and then put into this former oil-dieseled floor where a lot of people got sick from that.
That's another reason for staying grouped together and supporting Pacifica so we can have a counterbalance.
So we're not talking about nostalgia. We're talking about running this right into the future and seeing how we're going to stop all of it. And the Chicago 10 film is a good place to start for those who may not have been around back then. It's a good place to learn some of what went on back there. I have different feelings of it, too. My friends who are younger who went to see it, a number of them really liked it, and they couldn't believe that this stuff went on. I, on the other hand, I thought it was very good, parts of it, but I also was very critical of it, too. It didn't express, to my way of thinking, the joyous aspects of the movement, the positive things that went on. And I agree somewhat with Jim's critique, although I'm not as down on the film. I think the film is a creative genius, actually, a work of true art. And
during that week in New York City, we were having the benefits of Biafra at St. Mark's Church. And I kept wondering why the audiences kept, we'd fill up the house, Jimmy, we had all these stars performing one after another, and the place would fill up and the audience would go. And the place would fill up and the audience would go. And it was a 72-hour event or something. I was pretty tired. I went, where are all these people going? Oh, they're getting on buses for Chicago. It was spontaneously organized. But it just fell together. But it fell together because everybody had the same goal. Got to keep our eye on the ball and see if we can not rest on all. My mother used to say, don't rest on all laurels. Anyway, I'd like to play something for you if I could. I'll do something in the key of G. Thank you.
I kind of expect to hear a cry, kind of a gypsy chant when you get to a certain point in that music, Peter. Thank you, Dennis. Dennis just brought in two more. This is someone from British Columbia who has subscribed to help WBAI. Thank you. Thank you very much. And she will get a copy of Chicago 10. And there are a couple of other people who are calling with their message to the world. You're on the radio. Hello?
Hello?
Good morning.
Hello, Bob?
Yes, that's me. Hi.
Yeah, how you doing? Yeah, I just want to bring up something I found fascinating. I saw today on the Science Channel. They are taking DNA from people who, a couple dozen of them actually, who have a synesthesia. Now, this phenomenon where one sense interprets another sense.
Yeah, you can smell a color.
Right, right. And the reason why they're doing this is because these people have unbelievable intellectual gifts, and they want to, you know, get the biomarkers, the genetic markers from these people, and they'll find the common genetic similarities they have, so they can basically get a handle on the intelligence in the brain. That's synesthesia is supposed to be some psychotic experience people have under the influence of LSD, but in fact it's a key into intelligence itself. And of course, the DNA that they're using to try to, you know, track down this gift wouldn't have been possible in the first place unless somebody by the name of Francis Crick took LSD back in the 1950s when he first saw the spiral staircase for the first time by any human because he took LSD. He admitted this 8 days before he died on his deathbed. It might not
be a gift or the product of LSD. It might simply be a way of perceiving what you have permission to do when other people don't, or that you haven't developed within yourself, but it isn't necessarily related to either drugs or genetics. It could be as simple as something like fasting, for example.
Yeah, well, there's a lot, you know, there could be, there are other paths to the same thing. Certainly it's a shortcut, but the synesthesia is just something that they're just dying to find the genetic markers for, because they see it.
Someone's always got a reason to spend federal money on something.
Well, these people, this extremely rare gift extremely rare symptom is accompanied by, all these people seem to have memory and that's off the scale. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
All right.
You're on the radio. This is someone who has a very bizarre obsession. He calls other programs as well as mine. I'm jealous, but other programs get the call too. And he does his impression of a Hopi dance.
And he's going to keep it up until they let Penn Leonard tells you free, I'm telling you. It's not going to stop until Leonard's out.
Maybe, that's it. Maybe. You understand these things, Peter.
I've had an interesting education in many areas. But especially, going over there and living in the gypsy culture gave me an entirely different view of our culture. And after a while over there, because especially the anti-American reaction to the war, I became like most of the students over there that I encountered. You know, there's a large American population of students, but they all do the same thing. Lo siento, no hablo inglés. I'm sorry, I don't speak English. You know, and you're simply ashamed of who you are, and you deny you even speak the language or part of the culture. And so, and also the gypsy culture and most of the European culture was so hostile to us, and we disgraced ourselves in front of the world. So they had a word for us in Spain. They called us Yankees. And different than gringos, different than Peo, and Peo was a non-gypsy, a Guyana was a foreigner, and a gringo was a gringo. But they had a new word for us called Yankees, like the Yankee invaders, the Yankee imperialists. And I was at a club one night, and some girl came over, and my kids were there too, my big grown-up, huge grown-up kids. And they, I can't believe it, she said. Yankees, right here in our club. It was a gypsy disco. And oh no, this is the Spanish. No, Yankees here. He said, oh yeah. What's your name? I said, Paco Pedro. He said, Paco Pedro. I've heard some BS in my life, but that's about to change. Play something for me, Paco. I said, well, we weren't here. You want to hear cigarillas and soriadas and bolerias? He said, give me a boleria.
Yeah, I'd like to hear a boleria.
I gave her a few bars of boleria. I'll play a soriadas for you if you like, or I'll play a granadina.
What does a soriada mean?
Soriada, I mean, the word means alone, but it's a really very basic form counted in 12s. And it's the only thing I do reliably well over there from their viewpoint. They think I'm noted for my soriadas in the neighborhood. And I've gotten a few olés from my seguidillas, but I've never played with dancers, so my rhythm is really off. But my expression is great. I attended a gypsy trial where I played a seguidillas one night with a famous singer. It's one of my few experiences where one-on-one we really matched up. With a band in Sevilla, it's easy because the whole band's playing. I just come in with the lead line over the top. But here I had sole responsibility for the melodic interchange with the singer. But it worked. When it works great. It's just wonderful. You become transported to another universe.
Do you ever sing with your guitar?
No. Haven't since the late 60s. I did albums worth of songs, but that was it. I was a slow bleeder. That was my shot. My little leaflet of poetry for the world. Because the rest is now all playing. Because now I'm trying to push the envelope for what's possible with the instrument. And I had this wonderful teacher, Mike Jingles, who live in a world of patterns of scales and modes and seeing where all the notes are in a mental construction of the guitar, because you're playing in your mind and you have to see what you're playing in your mind. But it's not impossible. You see the grid of the fretboard and you see overlays over it, like the lit up little lights are where all the notes are for the key or mode. And there's a system for interchanging all that. And so once I learned that system, that was what they wanted to teach me over there. I flunked for 4 years, I have to be honest. I did not get it for quite a while. But when I finally got it, he said, okay, well, now you can go ahead and play.
When you got it, it was better than synesthesia.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, but it was just a matter of grasping this concept of patterns over the fretboard. And once I got it, I said, I don't understand why. It was so simple, why didn't I get it earlier? I wish I'd known it in the 60s. I would have been playing a lot more music. See? That's a prayer.
Will you play some more for us?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. There's a whole bunch of stuff over there. I play every day in every key, so we did like three tunes so far. We got three more keys.
No, in 1967 or 68, there were concerts in the town of Woodstock, the Sound In, Sound Out.
Yep.
And you were one of the performers.
Jocko Moffat organized those.
And I had been given a house to stay in, and you came back to the house with us and slept. And I remember...
On the couch, I remember.
Right. Before dawn, you were up and tuning and played the guitar to greet the sun.
Ali Akbar Khan said that. If you're going to play in the evening, you have to get up very early in the morning and change your strings and tune all day. And then at 8 p.m. when the concert's ready, you'll be all balanced and focused. But the preparation starts early in the morning.
Well, it was really a beautiful morning, I remember.
What was I going to play? Okay, we did E major, so let's do E minor. Thank you.
E minor, sixth mode of the key of G.
When you were in Spain, living with the gypsies, did they have any memories of the days under Franco?
Without any denigration to the culture, they're very adaptable. There is a story that when Ferdinand and Isabella had the castle under siege, the deal was that if the gypsies would make a hole in the outer wall up by the corner there, that, and convert to Catholicism, they could have their freedom. So sure enough, the hole's still there. And the piece of the wall is still there. So they are very devout Catholics, but they also practice the circle religion of their ancestors at the same time. It's very all-encompassing.
You're on the air.
Hey,
can we engage, you and I? Can we talk? Say, can we talk? You really, this is your whole expression? Well, thanks very much. We'll tell him when he gets here, if he does. Thank you. was is Karen Dalton with Ottomantown, which is the same tune as Masters of War. Thousands dead. Did I tell you, have I told you lately that this is WBAI in New York and that we're in our eon of need? We really need your help. We need your support. We are a listener-sponsored station, and you are a listener. The conclusion is obvious. You must support this station, or why are you listening? How dare you listen without supporting? Actually, you don't have to support us, but we hope you'll want to, because it's not quite logical for us. I mean, it doesn't seem, how can we stay on the air unless we have someone like you who's willing to give us, 50 cents or so a week, $15 for a year, $75 for a premium. You get to be a voter in our wonderful democratic governance, and, you get to be part of a very successful format in education. We do seem, in broadcasting, we do seem to have run into a couple of dry periods here. But this is something that you must do. You've got to support WBAI. The way to do it is to call 212-209-2950. Pledge your support, and we will send you our thanks, and we will continue to broadcast the most unusual radio that you ever heard, or that anyone has ever heard.
This is Mitchell Cohen here on WBAI. I was just asking Peter if he would give us some examples of the things that he's been learning on the guitar and give us a little lesson in audio, which is usually a visual mechanism to show people.
Yeah, it's interesting because I have a neighbor who's a computer guy, and he's a guitarist, and he's become a student because usually in the summertime at least, I play in the back porch each afternoon, which is a Spanish tradition until you play every day, sort of a concert for yourself. But he was asking about some of the techniques, and he's come quite a way. So I'll share a couple of them with you right now. Let's see. I'll tell you that. A typical gypsy lesson. For 20 euros, you learn three tricks. And like my other teacher said, you can learn all the tricks you want up there every weekend, Peter, in the caves with three for 20 bucks. But until you understand this theory, you're never really going to break out and do something. But here's three tricks.
One is a Rusciato. You're playing something. It's a way of sustaining the chord. And it's a flamenco technique, really, but to use it on steel strings with moving chords in an open tuning changes the characteristic of everything, because you can stop and sustain that for as many beats as you want. So. That with four fingers, either a four form, which is the note straight down, little finger, ring finger, middle finger, index finger, or you can do it with little finger, ring finger, index finger, middle finger, index finger, and then the index finger comes up. That's called the five form, and that's the one you use to sustain your performance. That five of the index finger coming back up puts your hand back in the position to shoot down the little finger, ring finger, middle finger, index finger. Then the index finger comes up. And here's a big secret. You know, a lot of people that come to my concerts in Europe are guitar players. They want to see your stuff and your techniques. So for everybody out there who wonders how to really do this, go buy yourself a sitar pick. It's a lot easier on the fingernails and wear and tear on the hands. But that's called the five form.
You don't use a pick. You use your
four fingers straight down, yeah. And then the three form, of course, is even quicker. The starts with the ring finger, the middle finger, and the annular. Okay. I said three, didn't I? So the next one be an American folk technique, which they use pretty extensively. It's called a rolling hammer-on. Using the string behind the note that you're working with, you now hammer on the note of the scale going straight up the neck. By hammering on and then instantly clawing off, you get both notes in a roundabout effect. And if you spice it in like shaking salt on a sandwich here and there and you're playing, it really adds a lot of color and flavor.
But how is your guitar tuned? Because that's tuned not to the normal tuning.
Well, believe it or not, that's one of the most interesting things about this level of guitar study. In the key of A, it's easy to do on a normal tuning guitar. In the key of D, it's fairly easy to do, and it's very perfectly easy to do anywhere you want in any of the modes of the key of C. It's only when you go into the other keys that you get trouble using this particular technique. So what's fascinating about the gypsy music is every key that you can think of, they've developed some specialized techniques for taking advantage of the way the guitar works. So here I'm in an open D tuning, but I could be in a regular tuning, and I'd still be able to do, for example, in the key of A. It's fun.
That's amazing.
And I forget the third one I was going to teach you, but I'm sure it will come to me in a minute.
I wish the listeners could be here in the studio to actually see Peter flying over the guitar with both hands, not just one hand.
That's what my teacher was talking about, hand development. That people concentrate on developing the right hand to be able to perform the technique, and then they neglect the left hand. But this left hand technique is based on if you learn... Okay, you asked me about what they taught me to do was new. I would go around the neighborhood for the first couple of years over there, and they'd say, well, he plays pretty well, nice soliatus, but he doesn't play that much in the key of E. No, he doesn't. I can hear him talking about me. I've learned enough. Yeah, it must be a bad upbringing. Yeah, I know, poor education. But everywhere I would go for the next few weeks, everybody I would run into with the guitar shop or down in town, Pedro, look, and they'd show me something in the key of E. And it turned out that was the key, that there are seven ways to play an E scale, seven modes of E. Once you've memorized those seven patterns, that's it. The fret position you start from may change, but the patterns will never change. And that's why it's so important to play, develop the ring finger, the middle finger, and the little finger as your fretting fingers on the left hand. And the index finger becomes a close-off. It becomes a movable nut. Up and down the fretboard. And once you get used to that, and these patterns are relatively simple, and once you get used to them,
it's simple for you.
All of a sudden, you know where all the notes are. And what an uncrippling thing that is. So I know where all the notes are. I'm up here in this part of the neck. Okay, well, the notes are all over here. And
makes it a lot of fun. Anyway, you asked about Rainy Day Raga, and I'm tuned up for that if you wanted to have some version of it.
I'd love to hear that.
Especially dedicated to Monty Dunn and Midnight the Great and all of the wonderful people from the 60s who aren't here, and Jim Forrat is here, thank God.
Vibration out of the fret hole in the guitar. You hold the guitar close and you move it away. You get a little extra fade in and fade out. It's really quite magical, Peter, the way you play the guitar. Wonderful. Wonderful. I'm going to play something from one of the records you gave me of yours.
It's okay.
Thank you.
The entire album was my entry into a festival in Spain called the Melon of Gold. And I met them at a fair in Sevilla. And they invited me to submit a CD. They have a competition each year. And not realizing that I couldn't win a competition without a singer. But they did have afternoons, concerts during the festival for guitarists. Mm-hmm. So I sent in a CD, and I was over there a couple of weeks later. And Murcia is a small town north of Cartagena in farming country. I've mastered how to find the place, but it took a long time. I took a couple of days just to practice how to get there. It's a strange part of Spain. But I finally, Mr. San Martin, I said, I saw him in his office. I said, did you get the CD? He said, yes. Well, what do you think? Can I play? He said, oh, yeah, absolutely, you can play. We've all been playing it every day on the car radio. We all made copies. We were playing it on the car radios every day. And oddly enough, when I made the piece, I didn't clearly identify what particular palos they were. But he recognized everyone. He put a name to everything that I played. And I had played it spontaneously for the most part. But he had...
It was called the Gypsy Chant, Gypsy Song, Cante Gitano.
Cante Gitano.
And I was hoping that there would be some vocalizing in it, but...
Sorry if I was misleading in the title. It's probably...
We can probably count on that guy to call up and do the Hopi...
Someone's always going to object to whatever dance. You do anyway.
And here he is now. You're on the radio.
Is that a woman talking about the immigration raid in Pottsville still there?
No, she's gone. But you want to say something about it?
Yeah, I want to know what the latest situation is in the plant. How well the people in the town feel about the raid and what the workers are going to do about it.
Mm. Well, I think that there's going to be some courts that will be ruling on what happened.
It might be interesting to go online and find out what newspapers are in that area and see what they're saying about it.
Well, I'm not hooked up in the Internet. This poor squad on the Lower East Side is not into the Internet. Mm. I have friends that are, though.
Well, you could get her article. It's in the current Village Voice that's on the stands until tomorrow, and you could write to her there to find out the latest information.
Idea.
Yeah.
Also, the workers, now that everybody, the thing in Chicago has gotten around the country, the workers can, they can take their inspiration what the workers in Chicago did.
¿Tú Hispanico? Are you Spanish?
No.
Uh-huh.
But I think that it's amazing what they did, and I support them wholly, all the way. I think the workers around the country should do that. Should bring that kind of militancy back.
I like sit-ins.
Yeah, I do too.
You're on the radio. And you're on the radio.
I got kicked out of comedy school.
Well, don't give up your day job. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. Yeah, hi.
Hi there. Okay, I got to lower the radio. Okay. Oh, here I am. Yes, I call up because what we've been hearing in the news has been such a diversion and so wrong. I'm talking, of course, about the political situation. For the Republicans, the election has never been consummated. They just reject it. And the way the media has been reporting it has been a diversion, like misdirection. The Republicans are determined to take Obama down. Even before his inauguration, they're trying to divest everything. Not only trying to destroy unions, but making Wall Street go up and down until everybody is broke in this country. They're not concerned about the people. They're strictly concerned about ego and power. They can't take the fact that they've lost the power. And so they'll do is to bankrupt this country.
I think you're wrong, Carrie.
Oh, really?
I think what they're saying is, well, we've stolen just about everything that's movable, so let somebody else take the blame. Let somebody else come in and take over.
Whether there's going to be any light fixtures or any faucets.
Am I still here?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. A few more comments about some things that were said before. A thing about pornography.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what the difference is between what's erotic and what's pornographic? Bad lighting. Bad lighting.
What's that?
Bad lighting.
Bad lighting. Thunderous applause. Wonderful, Peter. Peter Walker, who brought the raga to the attention of a lot of people who thought that the guitar was a different instrument. And Peter Walker played for Tim Leary's shows that were at the Fillmore, weren't they?
Yeah, they were at the... Was it called the Village Theater then? Or was it across the street? I forgot. Who was the Village Theater?
Played for many WBAI benefits.
Yeah. I was telling someone this afternoon, I never would have gotten my contract with Vanguard if I hadn't been up in the middle of the night in Bob Fass's show and using the empty studios to swipe a little bit of your leader tape and with the razor blade cut down the live monitor tapes into, and then making copies so I could have little packages to hand to Herb Gart, who slipped them into his coat pocket and took one up to, I had made several, and he took it into Maynard's office up at Vanguard and put it on his desk and said, you might want to check out this guy. And Maynard came down based on that tape that I made in your studio to Cafe Agogo. And with only three people in the entire house, I played my little heart out for him. And he came back and said, okay, I want to give you a contract. And little did I know I was signing my life away, so I couldn't take any money from anybody else.
Speaking of taking money from people, If you would like what you're hearing here on Bob Fass and you'd like to keep the show on the air and to keep the station on the air, please send a contribution to WBAI, and you can do that by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950, and there are a couple of really excellent thank you premiums that you'll get for your contribution. So please send in some money and show your appreciation for Bob's show and for the station in general.
You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, everyone.
Could this be? You think that this is... sounds to familiar your voice.
I really wish everybody would contribute and lessen the financial distress and crisis, which I hate to interrupt this program to bring to your attention, but we just had a WBAI LSB meeting on the 10th.
Yes, I wanted to thank you, Monroe. This is Mitchell.
Yeah, I know. I was.
I wanted to thank you though for helping us and answering the door.
Yeah.
That was
my
very helpful.
My contribution was my mouth, my mind. Mitch.
I think you said it right the first time, Monroe.
No, my dear friend, I said that for you, but for everyone else, it's my mind. Even Tony Riddle loves me. But listen, the station is in dire need, and the world wouldn't even be as good as it is if it wasn't for WBAI and other Pacifica stations. But do you want to talk, Mitch, about the subject that Carolyn brought up?
No, well, actually, I wanted to ask you, Monroe, a lot of people listening, they only know you by your calling to shows, but they don't know that you're an outstanding artist.
Well, I'm an outstanding human being.
You're an outstanding artist.
But you do
listen,
paint.
Listen, my art was in many regards prompted by the problems of WBAI.
Well, you're a great calligrapher, too.
Well, I know you say these things just to divert the people listening from thinking that I have any depth of concern for the station. But the truth of the matter is, and let me just say it quickly, and Mitch, if I'm incorrect, tell the world. Carolyn Burden brought up the fact that at a finance meeting of the Pacifica National Board of Finance Committee, the chairman of the committee wants to cause anybody who brings a court case against the Pacifica Foundation, and one would imagine it was with cause, will have to immediately resign. And
that's true. That's
from
correct.
Even just being a member of their station.
That's correct. The chair of the National Finance Committee, for all of you who are still awake at this time of night, is putting forth a proposal that all of those of us who have filed lawsuits against Pacifica trying to defend listener.
I don't think that's legal.
It's not legal to defend listener rights that we all be forced to resign. Mm-hmm. And we've been fighting it in the local station board here and in other places. Last night we did pass our view of that, which was that this is illegal and we will not resign, and we hope that this doesn't get passed by the national board, because that'll put the station and the network in further legal jeopardy.
Right.
So that's where that's at. I don't think that's going to go anywhere.
Well, the mere fact that it was brought up, that this man has the sensibility to promulgate it and then to put it forth, suggests to me, because I have never, and I've gone to many Pacifica meetings in New York City and environs, in New Jersey they had a meeting or two, I have never liked the mentality that they display. And
it's a bureaucratic mindset, right?
Yes,
it's a
right. And Bob's program is lovely and delightful, and he cares about the past, the revolts of the past, but right now, the idea that you didn't mention this, that why you say you're involved so much, that the ballots for the last WBAI LSB voting for people on the board of the LSB were not thoroughly distributed, or whatever the problem was with the distribution of, am I correct, it may have run to 200 votes?
It's more,
ballots?
It's probably more than that, but
isn't,
you know, we're focusing on Peter's music tonight, Monroe, and on artistry and on all the beautiful things.
Yeah,
so maybe we could talk about this on another show, I think. I chose not to talk about that here tonight.
You and Jim Ferrat have been a great help to our pledge drive this morning, Monroe.
I know, and I'm trying to tell people if WBAI gets some money into the coffers, it'll help. But, when you have a station where people won't read a decent, generally decent web site, listenerforums.net, and the program director calls it a bleeping blue board, I don't know how to say this. People can go to the library, Carl, and for 45 minutes, generally.
I have a friend who does that up in Woodstock. He goes on every Saturday night and he beats some minor point of procedure to death. And then he goes into it again in more detail. And then he starts to characterize the players in the game. And that mealy-mouthed, rotten, low-down commissioner so-and-so who said it instead of at. And then and other gross defects of speech indicating his incompetence for office, etc., etc. And has anybody really, it's like I call him up once in a while and say, find the listener. You should give a prize if anybody calls in at all, if you've got anybody listening. Because I don't think a lot of people
one of the things,
details and minutiae of this infighting.
There's only a short amount of time left in the show tonight, and I'm also offering, for those who didn't tune in earlier, I'm also offering for anybody who makes a $25 or more contribution to the station, I have with me my poetry books. One is The Permanent Carnival, and the other is One Eyed Cat Takes Flight. And I will gladly send them to you for free for you make a donation to the station. And I even brought envelopes and stamps with me so that we can, I will sit here and write it out right here in the station. So, and send it to you in the mail as I go home tonight. So feel free to call in, make a donation. You could get the Paul Krasner book. You could get the Chicago 10 video, the DVD. And I'll also throw in my poetry book if you tell them that you want a poetry book. So there you go. Of course, it could be a commentary on my poetry that you may not want it. But if you do, and I'd actually, if I get a chance, I'd like to read a poem inspired by tonight.
I was about to suggest that you do that.
And feel free to keep doing it. The music is great.
Thank you.
Generally, I read more overt political poems. All poems are political. What choice of metaphor you use, how you rhythm it, it all has some political quality. This is a poem called The Bagel Lady, and it goes like this. I'm just waiting for the musical introduction here. I never did this before. The bagel lady gobbles chocolate chips between sales. When asked, she gives tips to strangers on what to eat, the better teas, and what it takes to please her. The first time LSD modeled her mind, she peered into a bagel, photographing the world through a lens the width of her illusions. The next few customers pointed, "That girl! She's the one! We can tell! She buttered our heads in canting mutterations and stuffed the manicotti with superfluous musical improvisations. Ha, 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 you can't frame me. There is no man Nakati here," she testified, leaving the stand. She swung her hips against the winter of her dreams, slammed the sexual door on someone's fingers. "You're a narc," she curdled, "but you're too late. The evidence is gone. I ate the last bagel." Thank you.
mention something that I'm really appalled at. There's a fire company in Staten Island that has been protecting South Beach, which is a community with a lot of very small and, I guess, flammable homes. It's a highly populated residential area, and this is the closest to the Verrazano Bridge. It protects 24 apartment buildings of 6 and 7 stories, 6 schools, 9 special needs schools, various ages of students, Staten Island Hospital, 3 nursing homes, the South Beach Psychiatric Center, numerous child and daycare centers, which open in the at early morning hours. It protects Fort Wadsworth. And this is a fire company that's trained for emergencies on the water. And Mayor Bloomberg has determined that Engine 161 should be closed. Now, I don't know who or what is going to take up the slack, but I think that if you investigated South Beach in Staten Island, you'd probably see that there were some very expensive homes that are going up, and that the fire is one of the notorious methods of urban renewal. And there ought to be some people listening now who care about that and who maybe could call 311, the city's number, and tell them that you don't want to see a valuable resource like the Engine 161 closing. There's going to be a rally on the 13th of this month at 11 a.m. There are people who are handing out leaflets in the Staten Island ferry terminal. And maybe you feel like calling the borough president, James Molinaro. His number is 718-816-2231, or James Odo, 718-980-1017, or Michael McMahon, or Community Board number 2. The number of the community board is 718-317-3235, and Michael McMahon's number is 556-7370, also area code 718. Mayor Bloomberg's number is...
Yeah, what's Bloomberg's number?
212-788-7210. That's just one of his many phones.
I can't be able to be that.
And, you know, closing down firehouses is, I mean, that's the last place that economy should be taken, especially if you believe that we're under danger of attack by so-called terrorists. 103 years of protecting the citizens of South Beach. And
it's pretty amazing that Bloomberg has gotten such a free ride by the mainstream press, and when he's closing all sorts of public facilities, including this firehouse, which is really crucial, it sounds to me. You live in Staten Island, so
yeah,
you know.
Well, I don't live in South Beach. I wish I did live in South Beach. It's a beautiful, beautiful area. And there are some enormously expensive homes that are going up to replace the houses that have been burnt down. It's kind of typical of what happened in the Bronx years ago, when if you rode in the elevated train, you would see fires every day from the in the Bronx. And
the landlords burn it down for insurance, and they get the money, and then they rebuild luxury homes.
You're on the radio.
Yes. Hello?
Hello.
Yes. I have this to say. After hearing Monroe's comments tonight, I think maybe you should end the program with a song of friendship. What we need is friendship.
Okay, thanks.
Okay.
What we really need is love.
You're on the air. Hello? Hello, hello? You're on the air. Last chance. You're on the air.
Hi, Bob.
Hi there. Who's this?
Tai Chi guy from Jersey City, otherwise known as Jan Karczewski. Anyway, Bob, this guy's running for governor against Corzine. He's a federal prosecutor, and... It appalls me that our politicians are being hounded by this man for petty little indiscretions. Even Spitzer. That sounds fishy to me, the way he hounded Wall Street and they got back at him, I think.
Well, it wasn't exactly Wall Street that got back at him. It was kind of his own voice, his own credit cards.
Well, Bob, I got my problems off my chest, and I love your show.
Thank you very much. How about subscribing to support it?
I think the prosecutor,
$15?
What I read, the prosecutor was way out of line making the sort of inflammatory statements that he did to the potential jury pool out there in that case in Illinois. And it's clearly that this entire, in my humble opinion, this entire prosecution of this individual is politically motivated, and that sort of grandstanding that the DA is doing, you know, poisoning the jury pool out there and making the sort of statement that the Duke University prosecutor was disbarred for. And I'd be surprised if someone in the fair world doesn't do something about it. And I also wouldn't be surprised if this guy's found absolutely not guilty for exercising free speech within his own household, even though they're listening. They're listening.
Hey, Bob, can you transfer me to the subscription line?
No, I'm afraid you'll have to call 212-209-2950. Thank you very much. Thank you. Ahmed Ali has just come in to join us. He's going to be doing in the moment, I guess, huh?
I don't know.
Oh, no? You're just here for the ride?
I'm just here for the ride. Enjoy driving in and listening to this fine guitar player.
Thanks, man.
You know, working his craft.
Doing my homework.
It takes one to know one.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
It's like a neighbor across the hall, and I got a little apartment in Lima. I spent a few months a year, and the size of the studio. And my neighbor across the hall has a place to sit. And every morning, he starts around 9 a.m. He does 3 or 4 hours of scales and exercises
on
each of the different instruments that he played. And then he has rehearsals all afternoon, students in the late afternoon, and gigs in the evening.
That's the life.
Yeah, that's the
life. Unfortunately, I still have a day job, so I don't get to do those hours of practice.
Yeah, the hours of practice.
I'm lucky to get gigs where that kind of substitutes for practicing, but that doesn't keep your chops as sharp as they should be. But, you know.
Well, I'm a humble student.
Some new scientific research that will help you to keep your chops sharp.
Which ones? The ones in my mouth? Or?
Two new studies suggest that substances usually associated with dulling the mind, marijuana and red wine, may help ward off Alzheimer's disease and other forms of age-related memory loss. Their addition comes as another study dethrones folk remedy ginkgo biloba as proof against the disease. At a November meeting of the Society of Neuroscience in Washington, D.C., researchers from Ohio State University reported that THC, the main psychoactive substance in the cannabis plant, may reduce inflammation in the brain and even stimulate the formation of new brain cells. Meanwhile, in the November 21st issue of the Journal of Biological Chemistry, neurologist David Teplow of the University of California, Los Angeles, reported that polyphenols, naturally occurring components of red wine, block the formation of proteins that build the toxic plaques thought to destroy brain cells. In addition, these substances can reduce the toxicity of existing plaques, thus reducing cognitive deterioration. Together, the studies suggest scientists are gaining a clearer understanding of the mechanics of memory deterioration and discovering some promising approaches to prevention. Previous research has suggested that polyphenols, which are found in high concentrations in teas, nuts, and berries, as well as Cabernets and Merlots, may inhibit or prevent the buildup of toxic fibers in the brain. These fibers, which are primarily composed of two specific proteins, form the plaques that have long been associated with Alzheimer's disease. UCLA's Teplow and his colleagues monitored how these proteins folded up and stuck to each other to produce aggregates that kill nerve cells in mice. They then treated the proteins with a polyphenol compound extracted from grape seeds. They discovered the polyphenols blocked the formation of the toxic aggregates. What we found is pretty straightforward, Teplow declared. If the amyloid beta proteins can't assemble, toxic aggregates can't form, and thus there is no toxicity. If this also proves true in human brains, it means administration of the compound to Alzheimer's patients could prevent disease development and also ameliorate existing disease. He said human clinical trials are upcoming. And at Ohio State, researchers led by psychologist Gary Wenk are studying the protective effects of tetrahydrocannabinol, commonly known as THC, and they found that administering a THC-like synthetic drug to older rats, speaking as an older rat, I don't know where I can get my share, performed better at a memory test than a control group of non-medicated elderly rodents. In some of the rats, the drug apparently lowered inflammation in the hippocampus, the region of the brain responsible for short-term memory. It also seems to have stimulated the generation of new brain cells. When we're young, we produce neurons and our memory works fine, said co-author Yannick Marchlant, another Ohio State psychologist. When we age, the process slows down, so we have a decrease in new cell formation in normal aging. You need those cells to come back and help form new memories. And we found that this THC-like agent can influence creation of those cells. Wenck added two cautionary notes to his report. Oh, I knew it was coming. First, to be effective, any such treatment along these lines would have to take place before memory loss is obvious. Second, the researchers still have much work to do. We need to find exactly which receptors are most crucial to the generation of new brain cells, he said. This discovery would ideally lead to the development of drugs that specifically activate those receptors. In the meantime, should aging baby boomers who are worried about old age mental impairment light up a joint? Wenck was cautious in his answer. No doubt because marijuana is suspected to be harmful to health in other ways. Well, could people smoke marijuana to prevent Alzheimer's disease if this disease is in the family? We're not saying that, but it might actually work, he said. What we are saying is it appears that a safe, legal substance that mimics those important properties of marijuana can work on receptors in the brain to prevent memory impairments in aging. So that is really hopeful.
How does one sign up for those trials?
I don't know. I don't know.
What I understand is how, having been no showing of harmfulness, where authority gets jurisdiction to make it illegal. They can't tell you what color to paint your house. So, and they can't tell you
what
weeds to grow in your
In
family.
Some localities, they do tell you what color not to paint your house and what color to paint your
it's
house.
It's not really illegal. Getting caught is illegal.
That's illegal. You're right.
And the other thing was the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. You know, you asked about working with counsel in these cases, that if in fact the society is permitting tobacco and alcohol, then how are we not, which are demonstrably proven to be bad for you, mm-hmm. then how, under the equal protection concept of constitutional law, can we be prohibited from using a less intrusive substance and selectively choosing which substances to prosecute or not?
The marijuana producers don't have as good a lobbyists as the tobacco and alcohol companies.
The Indians didn't have very good lawyers either.
Well, the idea that people are even smoking, even smoking tobacco here when they buy a pack of cigarettes is a myth as well. There's almost no tobacco in that. It's all artificial chemicals, pesticides, dioxins, all sorts of stuff mixed together. And it's hardly any tobacco in most U.S. cigarettes.
I heard on the radio tonight there was a movement afoot to impeach Obama if he doesn't go out to the Rose Garden to smoke, and even if he does somehow. Yeah.
Where's Billy Carter?
This world we live in is so bizarre.
You're on the air.
So contradictory. It's quite
Hello.
Surprising.
Hello. I just signed up, but that poor guy, the phone is ringing off the hook. Could one of the people, or maybe two, just not the guitarist. Leave the guitarist and the rest of you come over and answer the phone. Okay.
Well, we're dispensable.
Yeah. Oh, that guitarist is killing me, man. He's wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
Oh.
His name is Peter Walker.
Yeah, Peter Walker. I know. And if I can, well, is he playing anywhere?
Other people get up and go to work. I get
He's
up
playing
and
here.
I'm playing here. I know. I'll be playing in Europe a lot this year.
I heard that.
I'll be gone for quite a while this winter.
Uh-huh.
Maybe. Bob will let you know.
Well, okay. I'll go inside. This is Mitchell here. I'll go inside and answer the phone.
Thank you, Mitchell.
And if you called before and
if I'm playing
the
in
phone
the US,
wasn't picked up,
front
call again, 209-2950.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is you haven't really been telling the number so well.
Oh, I just did now.
If you go to
209 What's the number?
212-209-2950. Light another one up.
Isn't it 279-3400?
Not anymore. No, it hasn't been for years.
Oh, well. My long-term memory. Okay.
Yeah, probably the record company will probably set up some gigs in early March. Here,
yeah.
Because the record coming out. I leave on the 10th, but between the 1st and the 10th, I wouldn't be surprised if I'm doing something down here in the city.
And
so,
there is
I'll
a record that people can go to the store and get?
Many.
Oh, yeah, there's a bunch.
Many.
Yeah, just put a bunch. If you wait a few weeks, there'll be three new ones up on CD Baby. There's a new one already out called Echo on Pumpkin Square.
Songs and Ragas from the 60s.
I just put those up.
A Raga for Peter Walker. Mm-hmm. Peter Walker, Rainy Day Raga.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff on the end. Just plug my name into the internet and add the word Raga.
Uh-huh. Oh, very good. Thanks.
Peter Walker, Spanish guitar.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Hey, Spanish
October
guitar.
In Woodstock with Peter Walker.
So much, so I had to take it down.
Nylon and steel, 6 and 12 strings.
This is the year of the big point. With this European tour and two records coming out simultaneously from two different record companies, which are both going to promote it, I have a real chance of making it to the next level. I'm not sure what that is. But maybe,
well,
maybe it's playing for 50 people instead of 20.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure, but we're gonna certainly going to find out.
Oh, it sounds like you've done wonderful stuff. Those caves, man, that sounds great.
I've had a wonderful time.
Yeah. No, it sounds like you had a really good time. Okay, I'm getting off.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
212-209-2950. And you're on the air. Hello? Someone
Hello?
There. Yes, you're on the radio. Hi.
Good morning, Bob. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning. Good morning.
Absolutely wonderful show. Monroe was only half right. He said your program was delightful. It's also important.
Well,
but
thank you, thank you. You've added to its importance for the last 6 months or a year, talking about the drilling for gas that's going to contaminate the aquifer that feeds New York City.
Well. Hopefully we'll stop that, but I just found in the last few days, I don't want to take much time on that. I wanted to answer a question that a caller asked before, but the thing to do at this point is there was a forum held by the Department of Environmental Conservation last week where they were, it was a hearing actually, they were there to hear. Yet they were seated in a place where the sound was really unintelligible. So we're requesting another hearing, or at least I did, to the Attorney General's office, because a few days ago, the Attorney General, Andrew Cuomo, sent a crew down to take questions from people who were signing leases or had already signed leases. And unfortunately, they didn't advertise it. And surprise, surprise, this is just a big conspiracy to get this to push this through. I mean, to have a hearing and not advertise.
Maybe we should give a little background. I'm sure some people are confused by what you said.
Usually, when they have a hearing, they just listen to you anyway and go ahead and do what they want to do in the first place.
Well, they set this hearing up so that they couldn't even hear the people who had things to say. That's what he said.
Oh, strategy B.
But,
well, very briefly, what this has to do is with is natural gas extraction, and
from where?
From upstate New York, within the watershed area for the drinking water of New York and Philadelphia, and
is there any natural gas up there?
Oh, is there? Yeah, in the shale, and in order to make the shale release the gas, they have to. What they do, I don't know what they have to, but the method that they use is to inject high-pressure steam, water, which has, 228 different toxic chemicals in it?
280.
And where does this water come from? Well, it's taken from the river. And where does it go after it's contaminated, after they've used it to extract the gas? Back into the aquifer that feeds New York City. So it's a disastrous idea. And once again, it's
the total
a triumph
cost per
of
cubic foot of gas
capitalism.
Has anybody calculated that?
They have, but let me just give a website, because what's sure. happened is the time for public comment on this is there's a deadline of December 15th, which is only three more days. You would go to Delaware Riverkeeper, and their flyer that they put out at this last meeting is that very briefly it says no hearing is being held for 8 million New York City residents who rely on the Delaware River water. No hearing is being held within the New York City watershed drainage area, and no hearing is being held for the 7 million people who drink Delaware River water downstream of the river.
I live upstate. I haven't heard a word about it.
I know.
What's the website? What's the website again?
DelawareRiverKeeper.org.
Uh-huh. We had a garage being built, and they wanted to use thermal heating. And I asked my brother, from the ground. And asked my brother about it. He said, no, they'd have to go down, thousands and thousands of feet to really get thermal. So what are they getting? They're getting the ambient heat of the earth. So they went through the song and dance. It cost $300,000 to equip the building with this stuff. And it's supposed to save us money by lowering the heat bill for the building by running the water through all these pipes that are dug deep in the ground, 270 holes in the ground. But now the whole project's done, and the town of Woodstock gets a $6,000 bill every month for the electricity to run the pumps to pump all that water down and to bring it up to 55 degrees. I mean, if you simply examine the economics and the dollar and cents of these technologies, what do you think the machine that inserts that pollution stuff into the earth is going to cause? And what is the net cost to the consumer per gallon of distilled
Let me explain something to you quickly. I've been educated against my will on this. It's not necessary to go down that far. It's only necessary to go down 6 feet. So in the country, if you were to put in a swimming pool with an 8-foot depth, all you have to do is lay out a grid of tubing below the swimming pool. And long story short, you only have to go down 6 to 8 feet to reach an ambient temperature of 55 degrees. The heat pump, it works in exact reverse as a refrigerator.
Why did they go down 270 feet? They went down 270 feet.
It's unnecessary. They took you guys for a ride.
They certainly did. I had no doubt about that.
Well, the other quick thing on the natural gas drilling is this is the Marcellus shale deposit, and what they do is look for the richest colored shale, the darkest shale, when they drill their exploratory holes. But what happens is the darkest color shale is also has the highest radioactivity. So when this water comes back out of the ground, not only is it toxic, it's also radioactive. I put these questions to the Attorney General's office 2 days ago, and they say that they're not responsible. So I don't know who's responsible. But
have you checked into the entire watershed of this part of New York? Because a lot of people are having problems. I wouldn't drink water from my tap. I drink bottled water, and I can't drink or even bathe in the water from my other house in Bay.
I would drink muddy water and live in a hollow log.
No, but we're not the only ones. I don't think it's just the gas. I think there's other problems. There's the pockets of the pollution upstate. There's the general acid rain, which is soaking into the water table.
Well, your water is still pure. There are streams that you can lay down in and just drink the water from. It's that pure up here, and that's the criminality.
Not in Woodstock.
Well, you're
even with all the
Fred is not in Woodstock. He's closer to Bethel.
And Woodstock is not in the watershed area. Anyway,
it's a narrow valley.
I have some more names of people who pledged their support to WBAI. May I read them?
Absolutely.
John Karaszewski, thank you very much. Doesn't say whether we can say his name on the air, but I just did. Jim Dimitropoulos, great photographer, great art. Jim, thank you. Thank you very much. Stuart Fishman, thank you. Oh, says, don't mention Stuart's name. Sorry, Stuart.
That was a different Stuart.
Different Stuart.
That was Stuart.
Oh, what a mistake.
Baines.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Here, yes, we can say Connie McNamee. Thank you very much. And here's another. Monroe Lippman. That's a familiar name. Has subscribed to support WBAI. Thank you very much. Thank you. And
nice of him to pledge to your show.
Well, yes, it is. Seeing as how I'll never let him on it again, now that he's a sponsor, I don't want to be accused of succumbing to undue pressure.
Bob, one newsflash. We're having an intense ice storm up here. WJFF has been off the air for about a half an hour.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and my phone line is in danger, so if I go off, it's because a heavy limb fell on the phone line.
Stay out of the reach of the limbs.
I'm going to drive home tonight. What do you think?
I'll get off. I just want to give one bit of information or a contact. On the agri workers from Postville, someone had asked if there was any more information
on
that.
Yeah, what the current state of the factory and its condition was.
A friend of ours, a good friend of ours locally, works for the United Food and Commercial Workers International Union Northeast region, and she was out there while that shutdown was going on, and when those 400 and some folks were arrested, and the youngest was, I think, either 12 or 13 years old, so it was even younger than 16-year-olds, and they were operating heavy-duty saws, cutting up carcasses and this and that, but... what they did when they shut them down is they brought in Lakota Indians to fill in, and when they didn't pay them what they were promised, when they brought them in, naturally the Lakotas walked out. And
that's all they did is just walk out?
They just walked out and
do you know what the statistics are on being assaulted by a Lakota?
No, I don't.
The publishers, they're quite extraordinary. I'm surprised it went that well.
An imitation Lakota tries to assault Bob on nearly every show.
No, that's a Hopi, and he's singing a prayer. He's calling all the, I believe, if I could take a wild guess, I'll bet he's going to continue to do that until they let Leonard Peltier go. So I don't think they had a recent parole hearing. I don't think it went well for him.
I just have to say though, and I'll jump off. As far as the music tonight, Peter, you're absolutely astounding. And I don't know if you know Tommy Lucas, if you've heard of him or.
The name rings a bell. I'm just walking this musical path which circumstance and life has led me to.
Well,
I like where it's going, so I'm going to continue to go there.
Well, he taught Jose Feliciano how to play and.
Jose and I played some of the same basket houses in 1965 around 4 a.m. Jose, who'd been playing all day wherever he was anyway, like we all had.
Yeah.
Yeah, we were on a set of string today.
He's doing a concert weekend.
He used to sit on my little stool in my guitar store up in Cambridge, the Folklore Center, and play his heart out. I mean, anybody in the world ever deserved the success and recognition that he got, it was him, because he mastered not only this theory that I've been talking about on the show, but he applied it. He applied it with creative passion, and his execution of his chops is just brilliant. His singing, I mean, the guy's
an
all-around certified genius, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
Well, I hope Bob does announce when you're back in town in March, because I'll make it a point to come and see you. Really, really appreciate your music. I hope there's time for a bit more.
I'll be back from February 4th to March 14th.
Oh, no, I meant this evening.
Oh,
well,
maybe
we do have time for one more. Then
let me see what I got.
We're going to get out of here soon so Ahmed Ali can do his show.
Okay, take care, Bob. Take care.
I'm assuming Ibrahim is either somewhere in the building or fastly approaching.
I'm just spectating.
You're studying radio.
Yeah, I just finished that course. We're just doing tech training at WUSB in Stony Brook. And although this is WBAI in New York, don't want to confuse anybody. Yeah, doing tech training out there now and finishing up. They just had a fundraiser last night at a little place out in Patch Hall called Bobby Q. And so many of the staff and alumni... there are musicians. They had a great big jam session, and it was pretty nice. So it's a good expanding experience, and being around a similar type of radio station on Long Island. It's closer to home for me and everything. And they are Pacifica affiliates, so it's like just branching out a little bit. Thank you.
Walker. It's great to be sitting in the same room with you. And it's really wonderful when you play the guitar, too. Thanks very much.
So great to be here. Are you in a hurry to run out?
To immigrants, anarchists, revolutionaries, hippies, punks, assorted wackos, and dreamers. Holy men, too, have walked these streets.
Chavez, Chavez.
Sometimes people from these different worlds collide. This is a story about a crazed ethnomusicologist and how in the 1950s he came to record hundreds of hours of Jewish liturgical songs sung by an Orthodox rabbi who embodied Jewish musical traditions that go back 1,000 years. The rabbi and the ethnomusicologist have both passed on, but the recordings still exist. And the story of this improbable collaboration lives on in the mind of the rabbi's grandson, 81-year-old Lionel Ziprin, a Lower East Side character in his own right.
I'm an oxygen junkie.
Ziprin's elfin face sports a long white beard. If you saw him on the street wearing his black hat, he'd strike you as just another elderly Orthodox Jew. These days, Ziprin hangs out at a yeshiva, a Jewish religious school, with men who study the holy texts. But his past includes episodes in the city's amphetamine poetry and hipster communities. It has taken its toll.
I'm on artificial life support, pulmonary, 21 hours of the day. And the doctor says, if you don't keep this up, you won't live. This is what's keeping you alive.
Ziprin lives in an apartment crammed with books, papers, and photographs of his family. He came home from a recent hospital stay and found his children tidying up, ever since he's been afraid that his kids carted off his grandfather's precious recordings. So I offered to help him search.
Oh, God, Zeta. Wait. Stick your head in here. See this box?
Okay, okay.
Careful.
Okay. I got it. It looks like it's taped up.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero on your felicidad.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.